Albert Einstein continues to intrigue and influence, to elicit admiration and criticism, as evidenced by recently published biographies. But I thought some of what, I won't read the whole thing, but it says, despite his scientific rationalism, Einstein was touched by a sense of mystery, a quiet confidence in the unity and harmony of the universe. He believed, quote, the most beautiful and profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the source of all true science. To know that what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty. This knowledge, this feeling at the center of true religiousness is the at the center of true religiousness. He warned that science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I thought that was really very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it talks about his Jewish identity and how important that was to him and how he never wanted to lose that.
Mm-hmm. Some chorus. In this vein, though slightly different, I reread Adam and Archetype, and this the extra time I have now that summer things slowed down a bit, and came across these quotes which I thought were beautiful and which sum up a lot that we've done. So it'd be sort of a dessert for what we've struggled through the last 60 hours. The merger of science and power is an expression of the fact that the age of natural science has increasingly lost the critical faculty concerning matters of the spirit. I'll read it and then we'll go through it sentence by sentence. It may well have commanded the intellect, but it has not found any adequate expression for the spiritual aspect of emotional life. Now, as the traditional spirit that we know has been contaminated with the greed for power, spiritual perception has to come flowing to us from a place that natural science has dispossessed of all meaning from the start, namely nature itself, from the earth and its apparent non-spirituality. So you do well to opt for phonic wisdom and for a union of oratorium and laboratorium, although this has nothing to do with church or polytechnic, but rather with the issue of the real and actual life of the individual. That's Jung de Pali. Let's go through it. The merger of science and power. And so what he's saying there is the problem is that science has been infected by the power drive. It's no longer the pursuit of knowledge, which is what it is in the best sense, but it's inseparable from technology. Is an expression of the fact that the age of natural science has increasingly lost the critical faculty concerning matters of the spirit, meaning that the ability to, I understand this, the ability to discern spiritual value has been lost from our contemporary consciousness because science replaced medieval religion. That the ability to discern religious and spiritual values has been lost to our time because science has become our main mode, and the ability to discern that, which is something the Middle Ages did have, has been lost. So science has become infected with power, and science, as infected with power, has taken the place of our ability to discern spiritual values. So he has a swipe at science, but wait, he's going to have a swipe at religion in a second. It may well have command of the intellect, but it has not found any adequate expression for the spiritual aspect of emotional life. That's just saying what we just said. And, you know, the spiritual aspect of the emotional life would be the purpose of the emotions that we've talked about with Pauli and Savon France, but it had a purpose. That's how I would understand the spiritual aspect.
What was that?
When he says the spiritual aspect of emotional life, it's not just that it's cost us our ability to feel emotions, but to understand that emotions have a purpose. And with Pauli, that purpose was the writing of work with von Franz and That's the spirit, in, as Jung defines the spirit.
You know, we often think about that territory out there, the science and the other part. But I wonder if this doesn't have application to almost everything in that. You know, I mean, like you take maybe like dance, would this mentality mean that people who write dance movement begin to think of it in a scientific term?
Well, I think he's saying that science has affected our entire way of looking at things.
Yeah.
That it's taken our ability to value away from us.
And that would include art.
Include everything. Yeah.
Theology.
Oh, definitely theology. Yeah. Just wait. He's just getting warmed up. But he has a solution. That's what I find so lovely here. There is a solution. So that's science. Now, as the traditional spirit, that would be Christianity. Now, as the traditional spirit that we know has been contaminated with the greed for power. So our religion is likewise contaminated with power. It's no longer a relationship to God, but it's a system we propagate. Witness missionaries. At least Christianity does. Now, as a traditional spirit that we know has been contaminated with the greed for power, spiritual perception has to come flowing to us from a place that natural science has dispossessed of all meaning from the start. So, science has killed our relationship to the spirit. Religion has killed our relationship to spirit through its infection with power, just like science. So, where do we turn for a living relationship to the spirit? The only always, never, in other words, never gives up that position that there is a living spirit, living non-ego spirit. So where do we turn? We have to go somewhere that science hasn't bungled. Religion has bungled it. So we, in order to find a living spirit, we also have to look at what science hasn't bungled. And what it has ignored is the spirituality of the earth, and that's remained pure. Namely, nature itself from the earth and its apparent non-spirituality. So that would mean that the body and the earth contain the spirit. Christianity hasn't mucked it up because it disregards that there's a spirit in matter. And science hasn't mucked it up because it likewise denies that there's a spirit in matter. So you do well to opt for a thonic wisdom. That's what we've talked about repeatedly in Pali, that the body has emotions and desires which, when interpreted, give information about how life should be lived. That would be the thonic wisdom. So
through the dream.
Well, through dreams or fantasies or simply interpreting real events that desire lead us into, that real events have a symbolic meaning.
And Marion Woodman's work says the body itself does.
Yeah.
So if you've got any kind of symptom in the body, any kind of dis-ease, that's symptomatic. That if read symbolically, that's where the spirit lies.
Yes, definitely. And I think that's why her work is so important. It really shows the spirit in the body, which would be one avenue of the thonic wisdom. And for a union of oratorium and laboratorium, I don't know if you know those terms, but I brought along some pictures. The alchemists thought that the work consisted of work in the laboratory and work in study and prayer. And so the oratorium would be the oratory where they would talk and pray, and the laboratory would be where they would do their chemical experiments. And each of those pictures has... Here you can see that's the oratorium. That's the laboratorium. This is the laboratory, and this is the oratory. And that's got it praying on one hand and the chemical work in the other. So what Jung is saying is that we have to get back to a religious foundation of science, basically, I think, in that. And this is not about, you know, getting the church and the polytechnic would be the ATH where he taught. Not about getting these two institutions together, but about getting founding the religious foundation of science. Okay, that's the question then we're left with. How do you get the religious foundation of science? That's where I differ a little bit from Einstein. It's not religion and science, but it's the religious foundation of science. And as much as we love Einstein, you know, Pauli and those guys thought he was, he didn't get it. That he was an attempt to make the Newtonian world religious, and they threw all that stuff out and tried to start over. And here's what they came to. But before we get to that, a little bit more on what's wrong. The positivistic attitude of natural science. Now, positivistic attitude means science only admits as knowledge what is repeatedly verifiable. That's positivism. So intuitions, that doesn't count as knowledge in the strict scientific way of understanding. In other words, what you can communicate through experiment is the only valid fact in this way of understanding knowledge. Of course, Jung and Pauli are far away from that, but that's the world that Pauli is working in. So the positivistic attitude of natural science does not produce any holistic concept of nature. Since the experiment is always just a reply of nature exacted by a definite question. So what we get through science is little pieces of nature, which we have already partly defined because it is an answer to our question. The experiment starts with a question, what we get is an answer. So we are defining our experience of nature through our question, says Jung. This gives rise to an image of nature that is too influenced or prejudiced by the intellect. See, that's my problem with modern Jungian. It's all a rational understanding of the human being, which follows from a theory, not a non-rational understanding of the human being, which follows from the experience of an image. So he's making the same criticism of science, and I think you could say with respect to this stuff, that is the effect of science on psychology, that it's become a conclusion reached from a theory, not a theory formed from images. This prevents the appearance of any possible holistic governing of nature. So if we apply the scientific method to the personality, what we do is we form a theory, and that theory is a rational structure put on the unconscious, which doesn't allow the unconscious to come through in its non-rationality with images of wholeness. It's just saying what he said in the previous paragraph, but exploring it a little bit further. So as opposed to that understanding of what knowledge is, Pauli and Jung, I don't know whether they came up with it or they are drawing from somebody else's, distinguishing two types of knowledge, the ascertainable and the non-ascertainable. Ascertainable would be scientific positivism, that it is what you can demonstrate repeatedly, that is what is ascertainable. There are other parts of life which science says don't exist because they're non-ascertainable. But Pauli and Jung are giving that a word and saying the non-ascertainable still exists even though we don't have a method for investigating it. Synchronicity, emotions, individuality, astrology. All these parts of life that we know somehow work, but in the scientific method, they can't be quantified, so science says they don't exist. And Pauli and Jung are saying, well, they do exist, we just don't know how to investigate them. And the challenge for the future is not to join the scientific mind that says they don't exist, but to realize we have to widen our method to find a way to acknowledge the existence of what is non-ascertainable. That's what the Pauli course has been about. Those parts of life which we can't repeatedly verify, but we know somewhere in our hearts exist.
And they have to approach it how? Not by scientific investigation?
Well, we don't know how, but Jung is saying this is the challenge. And we're not going to solve it today, but just like we weren't able to understand the quantum 100 years ago, maybe there's a shift in consciousness that's going on that will allow us a paradigm to scientifically, quote-unquote, investigate these non-ascertainable things, and this is what we've got to put our heads to. Not denying the things that science says don't exist, but finding a way to develop a method to acknowledge their existence.
Yeah, I think the quantum theory, I think it was a guy, Jung, I thought it was that it is science, but it kind of steps in the direction of the not ascertainable.
Yeah.
And I think that's why there's excitement.
I didn't bring that quote, but Pali says that right out, that the if you look at the evolution of consciousness as implied by the evolution of science, that the quantum theory puts two facts at our feet. One is that the nature of reality is a paradox. Electron is a wave or a particle, depending on how you... And that it accepts as its definition of reality. So it shows that it's a step in the direction of realizing that what is linear and repeatable in singular events no longer is part of our method. So that, he thought, was a step towards a future paradigm. The other thing is, the implication there is, that the personality of the scientist in choosing the experiment has to be taken into account. So for the first time ever in the history of science, the personality of the scientist plays a role in the experiment. And he didn't know where that would go, but he thought that was definitely a step in the direction of a new paradigm. And where we will go in the next 100, 200, 300 years will be taking those ideas further. So definitely. And I think that's why Pali and Jung could talk with each other in the first place. Now, here's the solution, which I think, I have to say, kind of blew my mind. That was all Jung up to now, and here's Pali. This, and I would say this, meaning the solution to the split between science and religion we've talked about, the question of finding the living spirit. This is about getting right to the archetypal source of natural sciences and thus to a new form of religion. That's a biggie.
Nice.
So what I understand there is that, and this is what they'll bring out in the show and what we've seen Pali struggling with, that a scientific idea has a prehistory in the unconscious of the researcher in the form of images. The final scientific thought has a psychological prehistory in the unconscious as it's evolving within over a period of weeks or months, maybe years even, maybe. And the thought is at first an image. So it appears in the unconscious as an intuition symbolized by an image, and then only in time does it rise to the surface, and when it crosses the threshold, it becomes a thought. So that the scientific process, as you said, Ted, is highly non-rational within the unconscious, and the better scientists know that. Einstein knew that, certainly. And the form of those images might very well contain images of the future myth. So that the new myth is coming to us through the unconscious of scientists in the form of the images that appear in their unconscious as they work on their theories.
In that regard, I wonder, has anybody else, maybe a young, worked on Einstein's dreams if they were...
I don't think they are any, that I know of.
Because that might show the point that you're making. If you could get in, if the dreams were available.
Well, I think that's what we've... What I want to try to do with the Pali material is go back and see if I apply this thought to his work, can we see anything? And just off the top of my head, I can think of three main images in Pali's dreams were Sophia, Mercurius, and the Chinese woman. They were the three main characters on the stage. So I would then say that the new myth is going to contain those three images. So that if you want to speak in religious language, God now has chosen the unconscious of scientists to communicate our new myth to us. And the reason he's chosen, or she has chosen, scientists to communicate our new myth to us is that they're investigating the material world that religion, the church, has said has nothing to do with God. That's sort of a metaphorical way to put it. But what I get out of this is the job now is to look at what's in the dreams of scientists. On the one hand, those images are part of their creative process of coming to terms with, or coming to consciousness of new theories. And on the other hand, it is where we will find hints of the new myth, because those images will be images to be included in the later myth. So there isn't really a separation between science and religion. Religion now is going to be formed out of the unconscious of scientists, which is why science is so very, very important, and why we think we're fascinated with science, because it helps us create a safer world, but in fact we're fascinated with it because it's carrying a new myth under the surface, and that's why we're so riveted to it.
You know, we don't have the dreams of Einstein, but a lot of his discussion of how he came to things are kind of like myths. I mean,
oh, definitely.
He's talking about what it would be like if he was on the ray of light,
right,
going at the speed of light.
Right.
It's using the imagination in a deep sense.
Right.
So you wonder.
Yeah.
You wonder if there was some active dreaming.
You could take that as active imagination. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about Einstein. If you ever come across these dreams, let me know. But I've read a couple of biographies, and I haven't seen any.
No, I haven't either, but it's interesting.
But it's sort of, you know, we've done a lot of talk about what's wrong, and I also wanted to show you there is a method for trying to get to what's right, and that seems to be in time, that if there are scientists who are willing to do a deep psychological work, that we really start looking at what images are appearing in the dreams of scientists who are working on the nature of matter, as the next step towards a, you know, very slow but hopefully certain evolution of consciousness.
You know, what occurs to me is that a step prior to that needs to be the liberation of the toxicity of the feminine imagery. Feminine imagery is so toxic that people don't want to own it. So if a woman, for example, if a Sophia figure shows up in a man's dream, all they can think about is screwing her, or, you know, there's all this fantasy life. But in other words, until those images are honored in a way that elevate them to a sacred or divine space, a source of life, it's difficult for men in particular, but women too, I mean both men and women, to own those images as having power and empowerment and strength, because feminine imagery has not been seen that way.
Yeah, if I may say that, you're already caught in the problem. Suppose he has to do both.
Well, so it's always a both hand.
Yeah.
It's always a both hand, but I'm just saying.
But finally get to the deeper meaning.
I can see two parallel paths. One is that people who aren't necessarily scientists continue to work to liberate feminine imagery into an imagery of empowerment and divine source. And then at the same time, there are the scientists who begin to see them in their dreams, and maybe they're doing both. I don't separate it all out.
Yeah.
But I still think feminine imagery is seen through the patriarchal fantasy.
Yeah, well, it's hated, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's so demonized and seen as weak and less than, chaos, I mean, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Until that is elevated.
And it never ceases to amaze me how it is, I would say, hated.
You know, Ross Woodman said, there are times when a woman shows up in my dream and I look at her and say, you castrating bitch. I mean, he was very honest about that, because his whole point is, his whole point was, he said, we are on the precipice of whether these images will be released or not. Mm-hmm. And he said, even me, who tries to work at it, will see situations or something will happen, or even with Marion or something, and his first place is to think, you castrating bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, you were talking about the butterfly coming out of the crystal.
Well, he used that example as he started in the morning. He talked about the fact that the butterfly has that moment at which it's either going to spread its wings and create the energy that it needs to release, or the liquid is just going to dissolve. What he said is that the feminine will dissolve, just dissolve back into the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's the point that we're at right now. Mm. And one of the things he said is very challenging, because even somebody like me, what instantly comes to mind is, you castrating bitch. Mm-hmm. Which, and I really honored him for saying that, because I think until you can own the fact that this is what you're thinking,
how threatening it is,
and how threatening it is, you can never deal with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we have to allow men and women to be honest about what really comes to them.
I wonder, too, in Visions we have an image of the new religion, too, the Visions course, which is, and the woman's breast is dried up and will not feed this new image. So I wonder, with Nancy's thought of, you know, redeeming that, it doesn't suggest that that's redeemable right away, that's going to feed the new, you know what I mean? I mean, it sounds like there's a different path of, I don't know.
I think it's similar that... You see, well, those of you who are not doing Visions, in the Visions, she has come up to a point where she is, how can I put it, really dealing with what's going on in the world and her relationship to it. And what comes up is a dream of a savior, but the savior is a monster. And the monster feeds on the breast of an iron wolf. And that's the vision that Jung works with quite a bit. And the idea there was that this is not quite right. To give you a handle, you could think of the monster and the iron wolf as Nazism. That was like 1933, I think, right? Mm-hmm. So in 1933, see, things were just getting going up in, you know, 50 miles to the north of Zurich with Hitler coming to power. And in the dream, she has to stay away from all this stuff. But Jung says, she has to stay away. We have to go back and evaluate what the heck is going on here. And I think it's similar in that in a strange way, the chaos of history is meant to be our savior. That's what why the monster child is the savior. That the brutality, which Nazism would be the epitome of, but our industrialization is not that far off, is somehow a savior. And what it's feeding on is no longer something spiritual, but something industrial. And I think I was saying a similar thing here, that in a funny way, the spiritual is going to come through our investigation of the material. And what is beneath all that is this feminine that Nancy's talking about. That's the image. So I don't think it's all that far off. She got it. She got led there because she's caught in a love triangle. So you could say her matter led her to that insight. And we're saying the same thing here, the matter which leads to the insight is the investigation of atomic physics. So in two different images, but in similar ways, matter is leading to something beneath itself. And that's what we've got to understand. Does that sound feasible to you?
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I was asking her.
Did you say, though, that the breast was...
Yeah, before she saw that the child was born, the monster child was born, and the woman's breast was too dried up. That's what made it go to the iron wolf.
Oh, I see. Okay. So what are those breasts?
Huh? Yeah, I mean, so the image of the feminine is what, you know, I don't know if the new God image will come first through the iron wolf and not through redeeming the feminine. I mean, it obviously has to work together, but I think currently we're so contaminated, the feminine is not going to feed at this base level.
You know, it might be that those breasts aren't the feminine, that they're mother.
That they're mother.
They're mother. Well, it's...
Because we're too limited in the feminine image. I agree. Now, that's making sense to me. I think the feminine image is much broader than what we've contained it as the breast.
Right, right. That the feminine image as breast isn't working anymore. That's what it is. Well, it keeps us in the role of a child.
Yeah.
Feed me. Feed me, Mother Earth.
In fact, at one point in the seminar, Marion just shouted out, "Stop thinking every woman's a mother."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she just got wild of it. She said, "Until men can stop looking at women and you know, suck, suck, suck.
Mm-hmm.
We are not going to get out of this.
That might be what it is.
That sounds mm-hmm. way better.
A
yeah.
real affirmation yeah. of what you're saying.
Yeah.
What, I don't know where I read it, but there was somebody was, and kind of hit me, was surmising that one of the reasons why men are always distrusting women is that women, well, I go back to your point.
Be careful.
Go for it. Let's
well, this, this, yeah. no, this is the view of men, okay? That women, bearing child, they naturally are involved in something that is really sacred and holy. Men don't have anything that is natural to them. So they are fearful of their role in the world, and that all this mess that we is a result of that. I'm not justifying, I'm just saying I've heard a theory about that.
I've heard that too, that men had to create a source of power because they didn't feel that they had one mm-hmm. in the way that women naturally did who formed life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And that psychology of fear is...
Yeah. Yeah, like you could say that. Let's not get off on this too far, okay? But just to sum it up, I've often felt, Jung said women have penis envy. He should have said men have birth envy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. Mm-hmm. That mystery is closed off to a guy.
You don't want to talk about this too much, but just one thing that came up at the workshop too, and it just always bothers me. There was this really brilliant woman there. She's got her PhD from Oxford in evolutionary biology. She was on her way to a big conference at William & Mary. So we had lunch, and we had a great conversation, but one of the things she kept saying was hardwired. You know, it's hardwired into us. And that mm-hmm. bothers me.
Such a pathetic metaphor.
Well, yeah, and well, it bothers me that because she really was, but at any rate, but this idea that we are hardwired to behave a certain way.
Yeah.
And she kept using examples of how this is how it always is, and I kept, I mean, my whole thing is we are, the evolution of consciousness is mm-hmm. an anathema to anything being hardwired.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because as long as we are evolving in our awareness, then even our bodies have to mm-hmm. be changing in our responses to things. And so to go back and say it's hardwired in our DNA seems absolutely yeah. foolish to me. And
because everything evolves.
Yeah, that's yeah. going back to saying that everything's based on this theory, and she's mm-hmm. made a predetermination mm-hmm. that that's how it's going to be, and she's fitting everything into that.
Right.
There's a little justification for that, but it's a misunderstanding of Jung's theory of the archetype. The archetype is an inborn pattern. And I think that you could say in a way is hardwired. But the task of every generation is to find a new interpretation of that pattern. And that's what these people miss, that this is a fixed fact that runs through life rather than a potential for imagery which must be reshaped in every generation. Mm-hmm. And that's what they miss, I think. And really what's so dangerous to culture about them. And that's the lack of spiritual discrimination of science.
Mm-hmm. What I kept thinking was this woman, though, because she really was, I mean, we had...
Did Marion jump on her for that?
She wasn't, we were having lunch.
Oh.
There was five of us women that had lunch together, and she was talking about it. But no, she did mention it. She talked about... Anyway, she did, and Marion didn't say anything at that point. But she also talked about things like competition being hardwired, you know, and all of those ideas that we mm-hmm. have.
That's gross.
And that the competition is hardwired because it's how we survive, because there's limited resources, mm-hmm. and so in order to get them, the other thing I was thinking as I was listening to her is I thought, okay, and I couldn't even engage the conversation with her because...
That's the animus speaking. That's
well,
why you can't engage.
My thing is, I think having her in this work is an important thing because she's also being exposed to these other ideas, and so I wonder if she'll wake up in the midst of something mm-hmm. and go, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And then she'll be able to talk the talk that I can't talk with them because I don't know their work.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
well, I just wanted to give you
one question I have.
Here.
Something you said toward the end. Matter is leading to something... Does anybody write that?
Spirit. I think matter is leading us
something beneath itself.
Beneath itself.
Okay.
That's the image.
Okay.
That there are really images beneath it, and they are religious imagery.
Okay.
And that's why the most religious people might really be the scientists, not the theologians.
Thank you. I had a question too.
The three images out of Pali were, and I've recognized Mercurius, and
stranger.
I recognized the Chinese.
Yeah.
Where was Sophia?
She, remember that one Chinese woman elevated to Sophia?
See, I always thought the Chinese woman was Sophia. So, but it's,
well, they're pretty close.
Okay.
But the dark woman would be another. The dark woman and I were driving, dark woman and I, and so on.
Okay. Would the Chinese woman be a little bit more concrete in just the Tao philosophy bringing into the Western mind and science? Is that part of what she was about?
You know, they are so similar. I never really tried to sit down and think about the difference.
Okay.
But they're so close. I really don't know. I have to think about that. I better think about that, because the talk I'm giving with Benji Jung is on the Chinese anime figure. Thank you for that question.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
So you look at the anima being exercised as Sophia, right?
Right. In the form of Sophia.
Is this the first change?
I'll just pop this bowl of stuff on top.
Okay, let's watch this Pali video.